with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And I knew I had a hit when I read this book today. I am so happy to welcome James Rollins to the program. Hi, are you there?
I am indeed. Thank you very much. I appreciate the support.
Wow. I don't know what to do with you. You're so good. You are so amazing. You know, Kingdom of Bones is amazing. It's a thriller that I didn't expect. I mean, I always expect a great thriller from you. But this is a thriller on so many levels. There's so much in it. And I was actually a little bit hesitant. You know, we've gone through a pandemic. I got this book, and then I started reading it, and I tell you, from the very first page, my hands started just trembling. I felt sort of almost like a bark going through me, because I knew this book was going to be so great. And of course, it starts off in the Kasai district of the Congo. And when I started reading it, really, I had no clue what I was getting into. And that first page, wow, I can't tell people about it, but they have to read that first page.
Well, it definitely was, I like to start my books out with a bang, so to speak, and then take my readers on a big roller coaster of adventure. And you know, hopefully along the way, they learn a few things about history, about the area, about the Congo, and even about our current pandemic. I have a what's true, what's not section at the end of the book where I pull aside the curtain and I reveal how much the book is real, where it came from. So in case any of the history or the science intrigues you, pick up those breadcrumbs and follow them.
Well, of course, this is book 6 in a wonderful series. What I love about this book, it has these levels. You have not just your story about this horrible thing that's going on in the world, but all of the people, all of the, well, and a man and a dog story is always great.
Yeah, I mean, I do have a tendency to throw everything but the kitchen sink into my books. I'm always intrigued by, you know, interesting characters that I stumble across. I did a USO tour of authors to Iraq and Kuwait during the winter of 2010. It was just as the Iraq war was winding down. And there were 6 of us who went to 12 different bases. Now, me being a veterinarian, that was my official background, I saw these men and women working with their dogs, their military working dogs out there. And so being a veterinarian, I was curious, so I approached them. And I was like, you know, can I pet your dog? And they're like, sure, if you want to lose a hand, you can try. But I was really curious about that relationship between that dog and the handler. Did they just consider their dog like a sidearm? Or what was that relationship like? And so I interviewed them. I found out how deep that relationship was. And I knew I had to find a way of shining a light on that dynamic duo of handler and military working dog. So this book gave me a chance to sort of highlight that dynamic duo by writing scenes not only from one end of the leash, from the former Army Ranger side of the leash, but also at the other end of the leash from the dog's point of view.
I love that. I thought that was really terrific, looking at it from the dog's point of view.
You know, and I didn't want to do like a Disney version of a dog that breaks out in song halfway through the novel. I wanted to make it authentic as I could. So I leaned on my, you know, background as in animal behavior from my veterinary years. I talked to handlers. I went to Lackland Air Force Base where they train the dogs to see how they work with the dogs, how they train them. So to make it as authentic as I can, because, you know, I wanted to try to take my readers, you know, put them into those the four paws of that unique soldier.
Well, you certainly do in this book. And of course, this is, I'm sorry, it's Sigma Force, this is number
16. Yep.
16 of Sigma Force.
I have a believing that too.
Wow. When did the first one come out?
It came out in 2004.
Wow.
So it does seem like it's been a while.
Yeah.
I just, you know, those that might be wanting to try jumping into the Sigma Force universe, you don't have to start from the beginning. I sort of tailor each book so it's welcoming to any new reader. Whatever backstory you need to know or any information about the characters, I'm going to give you in each book, because I always, at this point, I think I'm the only one that's read my books in order. I think most people just sort of stumble upon a Sigma Force novel somewhere in an airport bookstore, online, at an independent bookstore, and they just pick it up maybe because of the jacket, maybe because of the cover art, and then they read it, because I want the series to be welcoming. So if you feel like jumping in with Kingdom of Bones, then feel free. There's no need to have read all 15 prior books.
Well,
Kingdom of Bones, first of all, I will say the cover is beautiful. It's very dramatic. And the minute I saw it, I thought, whoa, I want to read that book. But Kingdom of Bones it's such a great title because it immediately intrigues you what it's going to be about. And you have, I hear, the history of Africa that you blend into this story that is part of this story, but the history of what happened and how everything really, all of this happened in Africa.
Yeah, I'm always looking for a historical mystery, maybe a piece of history that ends in a question mark, something I could maybe solve in the pages of the novel. So this, you know, the book brushes into the atrocities that occurred during King Leopold of Belgium's reign of the Congo area. 10 million Congolese were slaughtered during that about a decade period of time. And I was really intrigued about the fact that it was a single black American missionary, Reverend William Shepherd, who arrived in the Congo. He was armed only with his faith and a Kodak box camera. He risked his life and the success of his mission to expose the savagery that was being committed there. So, you know, history that nobody really knows about. So I wanted to shine a light on him. So he's not only a hero of the era, he's a hero of my book.
That is such a wonderful thing that you've done here, because people don't know about this history. And I think it is so important that we understand what happened. Then we can perhaps understand what's happening now and what has to be changed, the attitudes that have to be changed. And when you did something like this, bringing out Dr. William Shepherd, I think it's very important, historically speaking, for us to know about this man, because he was someone so important. As you said, really shined a light on the horrors that were going on in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much there's that old adage that if you don't learn from history, you're due to repeat it. You know, we have a periods of time of genocide, and it takes somebody to stand up and say no. Somebody, whether it's a reporter or a journalist, because in my mind, besides being a missionary, he was a journalist. He was armed with that box camera, taking pictures, and the pictures are worth a thousand words. He was able to expose what was going on there, bring that light to the world, and it was that type of exposure that finally ended that reign of terror that was occurring in Congo.
And of course, you bring out the interesting and fascinating history of the Kuba people. Is it pronounced Kuba?
Kuba, yep.
The Kuba people, K-U-B-A. The Kuba people. What a fascinating history. And I was particularly enthralled with the story about the textile. I love that part where you write about a particular textile. Explain about the Kuba people, because I think it's important that people learn about them.
Yeah, the Kuba people were a tribe. They were fairly isolated. They were basically not communicating to most of the world, but they were fairly advanced in their technology. Their society was very open. It was very democratic. They were experts in metalwork and in textiles, much more so than a lot of their neighbors. And again, Reverend William Shepherd was the first one to make contact with them, and how he was able to breach that feeling of, we don't want to speak to anybody else that's outside of our tribe, was he took the time to learn their language. And the fact that he did that showed that, you know, he was willing to learn from them. And he did. He was one of the first people to sort of be welcomed by that tribe, and to this day, they revere him.
And when we talk about to this day, you started writing this before the pandemic, is that correct?
Yeah, I had come across an article in the New Scientist magazine, the title of the article was, "When is the next global pandemic due?" And this was an article that occurred in early 2019, a bit of a prophetic article. But I wasn't so much interested in the pandemic aspect of that article as I was interested in the fact that this article was talking about these virus hunters, these brave men and women that were going out to the field, corners of the world, sampling wildlife, looking for that next pathogen, the pandemic pathogen out there. And what was intriguing to me, especially as a veterinarian, was that a lot of these virus hunters were wildlife veterinarians. So again, that intrigued me. So I pitched this story to my editor in the middle of 2019, said, yeah, this is a fun story, write it. It was a big sort of jungle epic. We could have all this stuff about viruses and the weird biology of viruses, about virus hunters, And so I began writing the novel and speaking to virologists, speaking to medical doctors, speaking to evolutionary biologists. And I was about three quarters of the way through the novel when March 2020 came about. And I get another call from my editor. She's basically saying, did those virologists that you were speaking to in 2019, did they warn you what was going to happen in 2020? Now, they did not, but it was an intriguing time for me because I was hearing information from virologists both before the pandemic and the early months of the pandemic, and they were telling me things that I wasn't hearing. They were telling me things that was not being spoken aloud in the public sphere, whether it's public health experts or the government officials. You know, I was hearing one thing from them, but I was hearing something else entirely different from the virologists. So I took a moment and I thought, I don't know if I should finish this novel. I don't know, being that my novels are meant to be big popcorn adventures, they're big roller coasters of a ride, whether I should be doing that type of story in a time when you have medical doctors and nurses, you know, battling at the front lines, you've got families suffering from COVID. So I debated for a while, but the information I was hearing from the virologists was so intriguing and I think so important that I thought people need to sort of know what's going on, not only to shine a light on the current pandemic, but to give a little warning about what might come next, you know, how the world could better prepare for it next time. And there are a lot of information in this book besides big popcorn entertainment that delves exactly into what's going on in the world of virology.
Wow. I think it actually came out at the perfect time because I was able to handle this in a way that I have rejected many pandemic books. I've rejected at least a dozen already. But this is something, it has everything in it. It's the thriller aspect, the team aspect, because you have your wonderful team of characters that your readers enjoy, you know, from Gray and Monk and Kowalski and Kane, and Tucker, of course. We have that, so we're going along with that, and then all of this other background information, and, of course, this... I don't know what to tell people what they're going to find because it's sort of, I always love the reveal. And so as I said, when I started the book and the first page, of course, it starts off in 1894 and I wasn't sure what in the world I was going to get. I got to the Zappo Zaps. Oh boy. I mean, really, I was shivering at that first page. I didn't know. I was so intrigued. And
yeah, I love that, you know, exposing the fact that even in the Zappa Zaps, their story that you'll read about in the prologue is all true. Even Molimba, the cannibal that Reverend William Shepherd encounters and has a conversation with in that prologue, is a real historical figure. Molimba was actually head of the Zappa Zaps. He was a cannibal. So he is actually also a real historical figure.
Well, that's what's so exciting about it as I'm reading it, and I realized right away, of course, I knew some bits of this because I had been involved in writing a book that included Leopold. So I knew all about the king. I knew all about the Congo. As a matter of fact, when I was young, a girl, I wanted to go to the Congo to work as a nurse. So I knew the area and I knew the basic story. But as I said, with the way your deep understanding of the history of the area and all of the tribes and all that you bring in, so many of the parts that I want to tell people about of what they're going to discover, why they're there in the jungle, what's going to... I love the reveal. I will say, I got to that moth one. There's a section there about moths. Now, when I was a girl, I was fearless, except for moths. I hated moths. And I lived in northern Michigan, and in the summertime, there would be these big moths. I could stand bats. I could take, you know, bumblebees and wasps. But I had a real panic about moths. So when I got to that...
That's so funny, because my older brother, Doug, when he was a kid, we grew up in Chicago. And for some reason, he thought butterflies stung. And so he was terrified of butterflies.
Well, I don't know. I thought moths, I didn't know what they, I just, I, they gave me the shivers. And so when I got to that part in the book, I thought, oh gosh, that's my worst nightmare.
Yeah, my, you know, my, it was fun, again, being a veterinarian, to basically, you know, to have this virus that gets loose in the jungle that begins to alter the natural order of things, that turns, you know, men, women, and children to this dull catatonic state where they can barely move, can barely speak, which makes them very vulnerable. Yet at the same time, this virus is wreaking havoc in the biosphere, and it's making all animals and plants more predatory, more dangerous, more toxic. So it was a great deal of fun to be able to bioengineer my own sort of toxic version of these jungle animals. Great deal of fun to write.
Oh, I can imagine. You came up with some doozy ideas there.
I'm always looking for that next idea. You know, I always got my antenna up for that historical mystery or that bit of science that makes me go, what if, where's that headed? And then I try to find a way to cobble that, those jigsaw puzzle pieces together and build a big story.
Well, in all your books, of course, you are able to use this background as a veterinarian. You've incorporated things, but in this book, this really took off.
I mean, I again, back when I was first writing, there wasn't a whole lot of animals in my books. It was only until later that animals began to sort of pop up as sort of sidekicks to characters or whatever. And I didn't realize what was happening. It was a email from a reader who said, "Hey, Jim, you know, I've been reading your books. How come, like, right here in your series of books, does everybody seem to have these animal sidekicks?" And I realized it was about that period of time where I stopped practicing veterinary medicine full-time and was writing full-time. And so that side of my brain that loves animals, loves medicine, loves science began seeping into that other half of my brain that tells twisted stories. And so there was no longer being able to be, you know, the one side of my brain that loves animals wasn't being satisfied by my daily veterinary work. It ended up creeping into my writing. Because there's an old phrase, writers are naked on the page. We expose a lot more of ourselves than we think we do. And I think that's one case that proves that this gentleman could tell that there was something, some change occurred in my life when these animals started appearing in my books. And the change that occurred was I stopped practicing full time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the characters in this book, the ones that you're featuring, because I do want to talk about Tucker and Kane.
Yeah, Tucker and Kane, like I said, they first appeared in a prior Sigma book, and it also appeared in a couple standalone novels. There are probably the characters that are closest to my heart because, you know, not only am I enthralled with the fact that this dynamic duo can function so well, but also it gives me a chance to, like I said before, to put myself into the shoes of that dog and try to take my readers and make them sort of understand exactly how impressive these dogs are. And when I first wrote Tucker and Kane in that first Sigma novel, now, I vetted the story with some handlers out there, the military handlers, to make sure that what I was doing was accurate. And they were saying, yeah, you're doing a good job. But when the novel came out, I began getting feedback from readers saying, hey, you know, I like the book, but it seems pretty outlandish that Kane can do all the things that he was doing. I think, you know, you're overplaying your hand on what Kane can do. But what I was hearing from the handlers was, if anything, Jim, you're pulling the reins back on Kane. These dogs can do more than what you're demonstrating in that first book. So there we go. So basically, it's almost like truth is stranger than fiction. Is that what I was, you know, was putting in the book was real and true, but it was so seemed so fantastical that a lot of people weren't believing it. But as Tucker and Kane continued throughout future novels, I took a heed from those handlers and began sort of showcasing the true things that these dogs can do. Their true amazing abilities.
Did you invent the word sub-vocalized? Sub-vocalized?
No, that's not my phrase. There is these microphones that allow you to communicate by just basically barely whispering, but it's picked up by a throat mic that can then transmit words quite clearly.
Well, you know, I think, as I said, a book about a man and a dog is always good. This is just the kind of book that people enjoy. And so we have that, and we have the other members of the team that you highlight in this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing that's fun about doing a series is that, you know, you get to bring in, you know, characters over the breadth of 16 books. That's one thing great about doing a series is that you can pull off things in a series that you can't do in an individual novel. Let's take Commander Gray, who's the sort of the head of the Sigma team sent into the Congo. Now, in the very first map, very first Sigma book, Map of Bones, he encounters this this assassin, and they get into a firefight, and the assassin, Seishan, they almost kill each other. Now, by book 16, they're married and they have a kid. So it's hard to pull off that type of arc, shooting each other, trying to kill each other, being married and having a kid, within one book. But you can pull it off over the breadth of a series. You know, it takes 16 books to get there, but eventually we get there. So that's one of the great things about writing a series, is that you get to the arc of characters that you can't achieve in a single book. So it's great revisiting the characters. I have Kowalski, sort of the little of the comic relief of the story. I first appeared in one of my early standalone novels, but I liked him so much that I recruited him into Sigma. Then we have the new cast of characters that are presented in each book. We have a medical doctor that works for Doctors Without Borders. We have a biologist, a postgraduate biologist student who is has Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's has in the spectrum for autism. And
well,
it's pretty fun sort of creating these different characters besides revisiting the old characters.
Well, I think the book is great, and I love the author's notes at the back. They're very detailed, and I think they add so much. What you've done with the facts, you know, sometimes a book filled with lots and lots of facts can be very boring, but you have the great art of dialogue, and you manage to make everything interesting so that all along the way, you're reading dialogue, but it's just done so beautifully that we learn a lot. And then by the end of the book, we have these wonderful notes that put everything sort of clearly in focus, whether it's the origin of viruses, the search for viruses, and also about the Kuba people and about pygmies. But you've blended it all with dialogue, which makes it easy to read.
Yeah, my goal is, I definitely want, the main goal when I write is to entertain. You know, I want people turning pages late into the night. You know, if there are beads of sweat on their forehead, all the better. But I'm hoping that when you turn that last page and you close the book, that you're left with something to think about. And one of the greatest compliments I get as a writer is when a reader tells me, hey, you know, I like that last book, it was really exciting, but you know, I read those notes you had at the back, and I was really intrigued about that history, that science, and I saw that book you mentioned, or the article you mentioned, or that link that you put back there, and so I followed up on that because I was really curious about that topic. You know, then I know that the book worked on many different levels, not just the popcorn entertainment level, but had some resonance that raised some curiosity about topics that intrigued me, and hopefully they'll intrigue the reader.
Well, I do appreciate that. I love to have the author's notes like that, particularly where you do mention other books. And it was very funny that among the books that you mentioned, The Hidden Life of Trees, which I remember when I first got that book, I just fell in love with it. And I still have it on my shelf. And, of course, also Brilliant Green, The Surprising History of Science and Plant Intelligence. That's another book that I had read. And the third book I haven't read yet, but I'm going to read. And I love that you've put that kind of information in here. And there's things that people can Google. They can, you know, find out about the oldest virus. And they can find out about all sorts of things that they didn't know. And I know once they read this book, they will want to know about.
Yeah, my goal, like I said, is to... first of all, get myself passionate about an idea. You know, I always tell whenever I teach writing that if a writer is not passionate about their work, readers can sense it. Readers have good noses on them. They can tell when a writer is maybe bored with their work or just going through the motions. So, you know, I've got to be excited about that history that I want to explain. I've got to be excited about the science that I'm bringing up so that when I'm that excited, hopefully it gets infused a bit into the pages so that when the reader, hopefully that will be a little bit excited about the same topics, and like I said, then the back section offers them a little jumping off place to do their own exploration.
Well, I want to thank you so much. People read this and read these end notes and find out something about Disease X. Oh boy, oh boy. Anyway, everybody, they will love this book. It's called Kingdom of Bones, and it is a real thriller by James Rollins. What is your... You have a website, of course. So
I do. It's jamesrollins.com. It's sort of the encyclopedia of James Rollins. It's there's chock full of stuff about books, about writing, if you want to be a writer.
Everything you need to find out about James Rollins, because he is... an author talented on so many levels. I just love it. This is a fantastic book, a great read. And, you know, during the pandemic, I thought I would never want to read a book about something like this. But I found it, in a way, very reassuring to read this book. So I'm just very grateful for it. And I thank you again for being on the program today. I think it's wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the support.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Wow. I ran out of time. I had to talk to him. This is an amazing book. Oh, wow. Bye-bye now.